TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The Politics of Obesity. In San Francisco, where I produce TUC Radio, the school lunch menu is read every weekday on a local public radio station. This is what I heard this morning.
Here's today's school lunch menu, elementary school cafeteria of the San Francisco Unified School District. Today we'll be serving corn dogs with mustard and potato stars and fresh fruit. And then in middle and high schools, it's lasagna, which it says here contains ground beef, sliced white bread, and chilled fruit. There's a meat-free option in the middle and high schools, if you so desire, and that today would be cheese pizza.
And this is not even the worst food that is served in schools. There are many schools that get their meals directly from fast food chains. On good days, I hope that a mother who hears this announcement quickly fixes a sandwich so their kid does not have to eat such food. On darker days, I'm reminded of the terrible statistic that our children may die younger than we because of the bad diet that makes them obese and ill. A panel at UC Berkeley's School of Journalism called attention to the role of the food industry in our growing obesity crisis. The ingredients that make us and our children fat and sick happen to be contained in the processed foods promoted by the food industry and on the menus of the fast food chains. Fat, meat, sugar, and starches are also receiving large government subsidies, while farmers who grow fruits and vegetables get little support. There are only three academics in the health field who talk and write about the role of the food industry in our growing obesity crisis. All three are on this program. On part one, you heard from Marion Nessel from New York University and Kelly Brownell from Yale. You will hear their voices again in a lively debate. Here first is Joan Gossow, formerly with Columbia University. She's the author of This Organic Life.
My interest is in nature and the food system, and I'm going to begin with nature. A year or so ago, I was asked to blurb a book called The Lost Language of Plants by Stephen Buhner. And having gone through that last bout of books that told you how plants reacted if you talked to them very nicely, I looked with some anxiety at this book, wondering if it was going to turn out to be the same sort of thing. And I didn't. It isn't the same sort of thing, and I found it absolutely fascinating, and I'm going to read my blurb. If you've ever remarked on the miracle that every seed knows just what to grow, you ain't seen nothing yet. Just below the soil surface and above it, too, there's an unimaginable amount of communication going on. It's not only the plants that are talking, Stephen Buhner reminds us in this surprising book. We humans are immersed in a sea of chemical signals that link our well-being to that of millions of organisms that are usually beneath our notice. The environmental warning in The Lost Language of Plants will come as a surprise to those who have believed that our impact on the planet could be counted in fewer elephants and songbirds. Buhner gives new meaning to the cliché, you can't do only one thing, reminding us that it is disrupted communication we must worry about as we take our chances on synthetic pharmaceuticals and other chemicals that have no place in the living planet's ongoing dialogue. He begins by providing a well-documented review of some of the exquisitely modulated ways in which plants communicate chemically with each other, with soil organisms, with predatory insects which they summon to eliminate pests. I used to watch wasps hanging around my broccoli plants and wonder what they were doing there. And then one day I saw one of them carrying off a green worm, the cabbage worms that afflict those kinds of plants, and I realized that's what it was there for. The plant had called the wasp, according to Buhner. And plants used to communicate with us if we were as attuned to them as are the shamans in cultures across the planet. Once you've digested the notion that the web of life is more than just a phrase and that through their roots in the earth and their leaves in the air, plants are absorbing and exhaling a variety of chemical substances so that they and we and all of animal and insect life exist in a kind of smog of information that tells us and them how to stay alive. Once you've understood that, you begin to understand the dilemma we have put ourselves into with our chemical assaults on the earth and on our own bodies. What does it mean to this elaborate signaling system that since World War II, the human species has added to the earth's and hence to our own metabolism billions of pounds of new chemicals, 70 to 100,000 different ones, most of them totally untested as to their effect on human health, and that we daily dump into the water with our sewage all the processing chemicals and food additives and all the bioactive pharmaceutical drugs that we ingest or are infused with as we treat our various ills. Given our puny knowledge of how humans fit into this web, why is it that we believe we can healthfully feed ourselves with products torn out of this denatured nature and transformed into substances increasingly alien to anything our human ancestors evolved on? I just was eating in Berkeley, sitting downtown, and thinking that it was wonderful to think that one could actually eat food that was from close to Berkeley, if you lived in Berkeley, which you can. Even within the last 200 years in this country, food was mostly what your neighbors produced and what your local grocer sold. But as people moved into towns and cities, their connection with food became more remote. In a little more than my lifetime, food became regional and then national. And well within my lifetime, the supermarket was invented and became the place where most people came in contact with food. And then food became international. We had no idea, we have no idea, where our foods come from, who grew them, but we have access to more variety year-round, and we were convinced this was an unquestioned benefit. And now we are moving into an information age with regard to food and everything else. We still eat material objects, but we're even less sure whether they derive from anything natural. And when we think about eating in relation to health, we are urged to see the foods we eat as collections of nutrients. Nutritionists have helped with that, I'm embarrassed to say. Manufacturers rush to provide us with everything and anything in the world, and many things never before consumed by man or beast. And just like the rush of data we can access from the internet, the validity of these products cannot be tested by us. Every time we try a new product, as we are urged constantly to do, we have to judge its value, not by what the actual food looks and smells and feels like, but by the words and numbers on its label. So many grams of protein, carbohydrate, fat, or cholesterol, so many milligrams of sodium or micrograms of folate. We have to trust someone to tell us what we're eating, even if it's a power bar. Now, I wouldn't want to tell you that nutritionists know nothing about nutrients and health or that we're utterly ignorant of about what foods are composed of, but what we know is crude compared to the reality. Every living food is a constantly changing mix of metabolizing molecules, many of them unidentified, whose long-term significance to human life and health we know little or nothing about once they are isolated from the foods that contain them. We do know a lot about which traditional peasant diets seem to correlate with long life, which accounts for the enthusiasm about the Italian and Asian food guide pyramids with their emphasis on mixes of whole foods that have kept traditional Mediterranean and Asian populations healthy. So how do we approach eating in this country in order to avoid being part of this mess we've just had described to us? We are embedded, as I said in the beginning, in a sea of chemical information. As part of nature, we, like other animals, have instincts meant to guide us in eating and drinking from this natural world. Although as a generalist species, capable of trying out a wide variety of things, we are at much greater risk of poisoning serious mistakes than our animals like the koala, which eats nothing but bamboo and doesn't have to take any risks at all unless the bamboo suddenly dies. During the long human childhood, wise adults are meant to teach us how to eat. But we are certain that we come equipped with consumption instincts because of remarkable and unrepeatable study done before World War II by a woman named Clara Davis, whose widely misunderstood work has been used to say that we should just let kids eat anything they want, even in the teeth of exposure to 10,000 food advertisements a year. That's not what her research discovered. Davis found that when nursing infants who had eaten no solid food were offered a free choice of 30 whole, unsalted, unsugared foods, they were able to select a nutritionally complete diet. Unlike today's tots, however, these babies were exposed to absolutely no outside influences. There was no sugar and salt in their food. There was no television. There were no food-branded toys, no supermarket trips, absolutely no outside influence, and even mommy, who was the caretakers in this case, were trained to give no response to what the children wanted except to help them eat what they grabbed for. They had 10 little dishes at each meal set out in front of them, and whatever they grabbed for, they were to be helped to eat. But the caretakers were not to give any facial indication or any indication at all of whether that was good or bad. So what the Davis studies clearly show us is that we spontaneously differ in the things that we like, and that there's nothing that says that we have to eat 2 from column A and 3 from column B of any particular choice of foods, that all these things from all over the map can keep us healthy. Now, I recognize that as a nutrition professional, I'm treading on very dangerous ground here. And I want to take an even more daring leap, but by suggesting that deep within the layers of learned madness about food that we've all internalized, we all know, we have information about what to eat. Few of us, alas, are able to listen to our bodies. There is too much noise about food out there. There's too much advertising, too little time, too much moving around, too few decent foods to choose from where we happen to be, and so on. But what Clara Davis and Buhner taken together tell us that is that we haven't got a snowball's chance in hell of eating right if we don't eat food, by which I mean food, not food products, but food. Whole foods, if they are uncontaminated, at least come from the same pool of chemicals in which we evolved. As the notable British nutritionist John Yudkin once said at a meeting that I attended, just don't eat anything your Neolithic ancestors wouldn't have recognized and you'll be okay. He did allow that we could grind grain and make bread. Because when we eat things that tell our bodies lies, when we eat artificial sweeteners, for example, that give us sweetness without calories, or artificial fats that produce a fatty mouthfeel without calories, our bodies say, in essence, what the hell is this? What am I supposed to do? What should I do to get my metabolism ready for what's happening to me now? And keep in mind, by the way, that even as our intake of artificial sweeteners went like this, our intake of caloric sweeteners went up too. So we can't really fool our bodies. Mother Nature cannot be fooled, and once we start to eat fake foods, our bodies, we have no choice then but to read labels. We have to eat by the label because our bodies can't give us any guidance anymore, and that's a fool's game. So what should we do if we want to stay lean and healthy? I've spent a good part of the last 20 years trying to show why and how the foods we eat should be local and therefore to a large extent seasonal. Partly because we needed to begin paying attention to where our food was coming from and getting to know our local farmers. 25 years later, I'm really elated by the degree to which the idea that we need to know our farmers has begun to spread, and that it's begun to spread at least in part in response to the shocked recognition that our fat children need protection from the nation's toxic food supply. What's wonderful about all this concern is that it's a win-win situation. Locally grown seasonal foods are, at least at present, largely unprocessed, less traveled, and the kinds of foods we ought to be eating if we wish to be healthy. And the very things we can do for our children to help them eat well, bring them into the garden, as in Alice Waters' Edible Schoolyard, serve them fresh, healthy food by way of farm-to-school projects, introduce them to farmers in farmers' markets, and on their farms, let them cook fresh food in the classroom. All these things are also ways to support and promote farmers so that we can begin to create food systems that are ecologically, economically, and socially sustainable, which is my bottom line. Thank you.
That was Joan Gusso. He is Michael Pollan, author of The Botany of Desire. He opens up the discussion. The first response comes from Marion Nessel.
I'd like to get right to the political question, which is, all of you have talked about this environment, this toxic environment in which we live. It obviously is the product of companies doing what companies are obliged to their shareholders to do, which is to sell more of their products. And I wonder, and you've done a very good job of showing how systematic, how in the course of doing that, they would, of course, make us eat too much. So is it reasonable to expect them to do anything else?
I'm not one who thinks that collaboration with the food industry is either desirable, feasible, or necessary. We have a very peculiar investment system in this country. I mean, it's been explained to me by business analysts a lot that our corporations' stock prices are tied to growth. This isn't true necessarily in other countries. So there's something very peculiar about the way capitalism gets played out in this country as opposed to in other countries. As long as there is pressure to grow, they can't all succeed. Some of them can at the expense of others. They can kill off each other. But they can't all succeed. They cannot continue to produce more calories. And their only alternative, and they know it, is to raise prices or to add value so they can raise prices. And this gets us into the whole question of price, which I now see as the single issue that requires the most attention, and I don't know how to solve it. I'm doing a lot of speaking to businesses these days, and they're all talking about the need to keep food costs down. The single most important determinant of people buying food is how cheap it is. And until we can fix somehow the price structure, get people accustomed to paying more for food? I don't know what the answer is. But it's certainly all tied up in something that I think people have to give a lot of attention to.
I think we need to segment the food industry into players that are helping or hurting with the overall diet and support the ones who are helping and do what we can to curtail the activities of the ones that are hurting the situation. So, you know, the organic people are making organic food, great. Help them all we can. And I think nobody pointed out better than you, Michael, in your piece in the New York Times recently, that we're selectively helping the parts of the industry that are contributing to obesity. That has to be reversed. All the incentives are lined up in the promotion of the unhealthy food. If that can be reversed so that there are 10,000 advertisements for healthy food, and it's the fruit and vegetable growers who are getting the subsidies from the government, and those sort of foods are entering the schools, then I think we'll have a much better chance of licking this problem.
That was Kelly Brownell, author of Food Fight. He again is Michael Pollan. Marion Nessel, author of Food Politics, responds.
Can you imagine things you could do either to the subsidy system or somehow to the incentive system that would reward the quality side more than the quantity side?
Sure. You could subsidize organic agriculture instead of production agriculture. You could subsidize fruit and vegetable growers instead of the growers of corn and soybeans. Corn and soybeans end up as corn sweeteners and soy oil. I think those are kinds of easy choices to make, but that's not where the political power lies. I was in Salinas last week talking to fruit and vegetable growers. They're an interesting group. They're really trying hard to produce gorgeous vegetables. These were not necessarily organic farmers. They were commercial producers, but they're doing their best to produce fruits and vegetables for the United States market. And they know they get 5 to 8 cents on the dollar, and the producers of meat and dairy products get 30 to 50 cents on the dollar. So that they're working on these tiny little margins. It gets them into all kinds of trouble over labor issues, which is a very important underlying theme here. Unless they don't get the kind of help that the Iowa corn and soybean producers get, which, as someone in Iowa explained to me, that if those subsidies stopped, those farmers in Iowa would be out of business in an hour and a half.
The conversation then turned towards parallels with the tobacco industry. A U.S. district judge in 2003 threw out a class action lawsuit that blamed McDonald's for making people fat. He said, quote, that a person knows or should know that eating copious orders of supersized McDonald's products is unhealthy and may result in weight gain, and it is not the place of the law to protect them from their own excesses, end of quote. But in the tobacco cases, it was found that consumers do need protection from the advertising, targeting of children, and the denial that smoking is damaging to health. Marion Nessel made a comparison.
I think there's going to be a lot of talk about the addiction issue. And the lawyers, you know, however you feel about these lawyers that are lying in wait for the lawsuits, they are forcing a tremendous amount of change even before they ever get into court. You know, and I can tell you that the companies do not want these documents that Kelly was talking about to be revealed on discovery. And I just know that all over America there are companies shredding documents even as we speak, so that they don't have to talk about how they're adjusting the content of their products to encourage people to want more of them or to eat two cookies instead of one.
I thought a lot about the tobacco and food parallels, and I think the question about is food like tobacco is distracting, but the main question here is, did we learn anything from the war on tobacco that could be applied in this arena? And I think there are a lot of lessons, and you mentioned some of them. One is, if you have the critical mass of science on some key questions, I think it will take you a long way, because then people like the Surgeon General can't ignore it because he's getting bullied by the food industry, but he can be more emboldened. So I think there are several bits of science that could be done that wouldn't cost a lot but would be tremendously helpful right now. For example, I think it would be very interesting to look if the degree to which health improves and overall diet improves when kids are exposed to something like the edible schoolyard. That would be a very powerful demonstration. I also think the single most powerful things I think we could do would be to show an association between healthy foods in schools and standardized test scores. Because if you go into a school that's switching from a less to a more healthy diet and you show differences on SAT scores, let's say, you'd have the attention of every superintendent in the country.
We've been talking about good foods and bad foods, and you've proposed, Joan, some guidance. But how comfortable you are saying that this is inherently a bad food and this is inherently a good food?
And I think from a public health point of view, that no good food, no bad food is highly unproductive philosophy, because it makes all foods equal. And it makes the fast food industry say, well, you can't blame us. There are no good foods and bad foods. The candy industry, the soft drink industry, they all fall behind that as a smokescreen. And, in fact, there are foods that are better than others. We should eat fewer hot dogs as a culture and more broccoli. And to say that they're the same by this no good food and bad food thing is completely counterproductive, I think.
Yeah. Now, this gets into the whole question of societal changes, where it became normal to drink soft drinks and eat fast food all the time. My daughter was lamenting the other day about how when she was a child, McDonald's was a treat. You went to McDonald's when it was your birthday, or when it was somebody else's birthday. You had a Coke maybe once a week, if that much. So these foods aren't poison, but they started out being special foods for special occasions, you know, special things that were done for kids in special occasions, and they've now become a normal part of our culture. So we have to ask the question as a society, when did it become normal for kids to drink soft drinks all day long and replace water with soft drinks, and how did we allow that to happen, and how can we reverse that trend now that we realize what we've done?
Joan, you've also offered one standard, a metric for this. Is there one change you want to see on a label?
Well, I'd love it if we could do what I proposed years ago on a diet and cancer panel, which is that we could label the foods in the supermarket red, green, and yellow, you know, and have green foods meant eat any time, and yellow foods meant be careful, and red foods meant don't eat very often. But
I know. How do you assess the chances for that message?
Yeah, well, I.
We've had so much information on what to eat, whether we should eat more fat, more carbohydrates, that how much we eat gets lost in that discussion. And as Marion made the point in her book, in a way that the message "eat less" is just simply not allowed. And there's so many interests as journalists, as people who produce food. You can't say that. This morning I went on the CDC website looking for that statistic on type 2 diabetes, and they had recommendations what could be done to prevent type 2 diabetes. And Kelly had said, yeah, even the CDC won't do an eat less message. And I couldn't believe this was true. This is the Center for Disease Control. I didn't say you were lying. I thought perhaps you were exaggerating. And this is what they said. A number of studies have shown that regular physical activity can significantly reduce the risk of developing type 2 diabetes. They have to say something about food, but they don't. It also appears to be associated with obesity.
Appears.
There's nothing to be done about that. But it is remarkable that that is a taboo in public discourse.
I think there's reason to be optimistic with this in particular. Those of us who have been involved in it for long enough, I think, have seen a remarkable change in the way that the public is dealing with this issue right now. The press, 4 or 5 years ago, every time it wrote about obesity, wrote about how to lose weight, all focused on the individual. Now, mainly what you see are public health-oriented articles. That's a tremendous change, I think. And I think that's helping drive a change in the mindset of the public, our elected officials. So I think we're probably getting closer to the time where some bold and dramatic action is more possible because the social climate is changing to accept it. I may be Pollyanna here, but I think I'm very excited about the things I'm seeing going on now.
That was Kelly Brownell. He was on a panel on the politics of obesity at the UC Berkeley School of Journalism. The other participants were Marion Nessel, author of Food Politics, and Joan Gusso, author of This Organic Life. The moderator was Michael Pollan, author of The Botany of Desire. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on the politics of obesity on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a copy of the complete one-hour program on the politics of obesity by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. Time of Useful Consciousness is an aeronautical term. The time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for the pilot to save the plane. My name is Maria Gelöden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.